Questions about anything? So, exam Friday covers through chapter 14. We'll talk today about some moons of major planets, stuff from chapter 13, and that'll be the end of what will be on that exam. If we have time, we may go on today and talk about some asteroids and comets and things like that, but that's chapter 15 and it won't be on the exam. So basically all of the planets through and including the moons of the major planets.
Does that include chapter 14?
Yes. Yep. So we talked about chapter 14 yesterday. That has to do with Neptune and Uranus. So it probably doesn't cover all of chapter 14. Chapter 14 also talks about the Kuiper Belt objects. We'll talk about those when we talk about the asteroids. So most of chapter 14, including Uranus and Neptune and Triton, but not the Kuiper Belt objects. Other questions? So in the past, I've said that there were stuff on the 212 exams that were also relevant to your exams, and that's not the case now, right? So the 212 exam has gone on to talk about stars, and we're talking about planets. So the only relevant exam is the one from 211, exam 3. And I guess I haven't looked at it precisely, but I'm pretty sure that it's, so yeah, maybe it's worth looking at. Sometimes we get a little bit further into the sun. Yeah, so the online exam has some material on the sun, which will not be on your exam, obviously. Right, so it's just planets, no sun. We've had kind of bad weather to finish up the home lab, so that technically they were going to be due on Friday, but pushing that off till Tuesday. Looks like there'll be a few clear days between now and Tuesday. In fact, Friday itself is supposed to be clear. We've scheduled a help session today here at 4 p.m. Again, I think the best way to study for the exam is to literally work the old exam and come in and talk about your answers with me. The structure of the exam is the same as the other exams. 20 true false, 15 short answer, 5 longer questions, one of which is, well, for sure, I might as well say, going to be the winner hexagon. Questions? So, a while ago we talked about Jupiter and Saturn, which don't look anything alike, but have a lot of similar features in their atmospheres. Uranus and Neptune look very much alike, pretty much the same mass and size. Color, this vivid blue color due to the presence of methane in their atmospheres. They both have kind of an odd magnetic field. So they're probably more similar. They're probably the two most similar planets in the solar system, but they're not exactly the same. So probably the most important difference is that Uranus lacks this internal heat source that all the other giant planets have. Typically, twice as much energy is coming from geothermal sources for the giant planets. This is coming from the sun, so their atmospheres are heated from below, so they're hotter than they would be normally. But in fact, because Uranus lacks this geothermal heat source, it's pretty much at the same temperature as Neptune, even though Neptune is a lot further out. It's about the same density of Jupiter, but you probably shouldn't think that that should match to the composition of Jupiter. These guys all have to have rocky cores. For Saturn or for Jupiter, the much larger mass has compressed the objects so that it gets a reasonable density, whereas these guys have a density that is dominated by actual kind of rocky material. So here, you know, here's the rock of Jupiter, and here's the rock of Saturn. Oops, that's also Jupiter. Here's the rock of Saturn. And it's pretty small change, right? The composition of these guys pretty much matches the composition of the sun, which is way predominantly hydrogen and helium. You might remember that the atmosphere of Saturn has a reduced concentration of helium compared to the sun. Presumably it is fallen down, differentiated inside the planet. So here's Uranus and Neptune. We start out with pretty much the same concentration of hydrogen and helium in the atmosphere as Jupiter has, which is to say more helium than Saturn has. And we've got this thick saltwater ocean, as it were, of what we usually call ices. That is the source of the conducting convecting fluid that is producing the magnetic field of these guys. And then a rock that is probably not all that different from the rock in Jupiter and Saturn, simply hasn't accreted as much gaseous stuff to make a big planet. And again, shouldn't think of this thing as being solid. These things are hot on the inside. If you drop a probe on any of the giant planets, it just goes down, 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 down until it's crushed. No solid surface. Questions on sometimes called the ice giant planets? So kind of in physical size, maybe kind of 4 times bigger than the Earth as opposed to 10 times bigger than the Earth for Jupiter and Saturn. Yeah, it might be helpful to flash this thing that gives kind of an overall scale of the objects we're talking about. All right, so here's the edge of the Sun, huge in comparison to anything else. And we've got Jupiter and Saturn pretty much the same, Uranus and Neptune pretty much the same, noticeably smaller than Saturn. The twins that aren't twins, and we're going down this list, and the plan today is to cover all of these smallish, but I would say nonetheless interesting moons. And probably next time go on to talk, I guess none of the asteroids are on here, talk then about some of the asteroids. Incidentally, the book has a lot, and it's maybe interesting stuff, about all of the minor moons, particularly of Saturn, and I don't care about those. Those won't be on the exam. The only moons I'm going to ask you about are the moons that are on that list. And of course, our moon when it comes time for the final. Mars has a couple of moons. They're moderately interesting. I didn't talk about them at the time. They're very small. They don't fit on this list at all. And for a while, people thought that they were captured asteroids, but it looks like they're probably more formed like our moon was. That is to say, giant collision throws stuff in orbit around the planet, which then coalesces into the various moons. And I guess the other thing that brings in mind talking about them now is that one of them is at least very close to the Roche limit. So the Roche limit, you remember, is how close you can be to a planet before when you drop a glove, it doesn't fall down, it falls up, drifts away. So the space station, things drift away from it. They aren't gravitationally attracted to the space station. And you might think that just has to do with the fact that the space station doesn't weigh much, but it really has to do with the location of the space station. It's too close to the Earth. The Earth's gravitational force is going to dominate. So unless the space station were riveted together, it would go its merry separate ways. And the same thing would be true of a moon that wasn't monolithic, that wasn't held together by chemical forces, riveted together as it were. So roughly speaking, and this number 2.5 is up for negotiation, roughly speaking, the Roche limit is about 2.5 times the planet's radius. And if there are radical differences in density between the planet and the moon, then that can also have a somewhat minor effect on the distance, the close approach. But usually, the rocks that are orbiting the planet are pretty similar to the planet, and so the ratio of densities is just one. So close enough, you can be within 2.5 times the planet's radius before you start to have your surface vacuumed up by the gravitational force of the main planet. So that has to do with the rings of these things. And as far as we can figure out, the rings are disrupted objects that came within the Roche limit of the, I don't know which one of these I like best. We'll go with this one. Came within the Roche limit, and all the giant planets have rings. This picture has been scaled so that the radius of the planets are all the same. And you can see that pretty much all of the rings then lie within this limit of about 2.5 times the radius of the planet. The only rings that are noticeably visible from Earth are the rings of Saturn. So Galileo in his telescope actually saw something unusual about Saturn. He didn't recognize them as rings. He thought that actually Saturn might have had moons, big moons, that were on either side of it. But he noticed that something was unusual with Saturn right off the bat. The rings are immediate and obvious. And that's because the ring material is ice, so it's highly reflective. The ring material for the other planets is typically darker material, so it doesn't reflect light very much. It does a better job of scattering light. So if you're behind the planet, you can see those rings better than if you're looking in the same direction as the sun is. So also notice that none of these planetary rings are nearly as huge as Saturn's are. So Uranus is kind of, I would say, second best in terms of rings. And it was actually the next rings that were discovered were Uranus's rings. They weren't imaged, but what was detected was that as Uranus moved in front of a distant star, the light of the star dimmed and reappeared as if it was being interrupted by something before the star reached the surface of Uranus. So that's how these guys were detected, not by their reflected light, but by their absorbed light. So these things are mostly gap, with relatively little in the way of cheek-to-jowl rings, the way Saturn's are. And Neptune's are even more sparse, and we remember that Neptune had these kind of arc rings. And the rings are kind of slowly disappearing with time, over just the time scale that we've sent spacecraft by it. Jupiter's rings are made out of very fine dust particles, so they're kind of last on the list of impressive rings. The rings aren't uniform. They are sculpted by various phenomena. So there's a big gap between the A and the B rings called the Cassini gap, and that gap is due to a resonance. So what a resonance is, it's a situation where you have a match between the orbital period of a particle that's in the ring and a surrounding moon. And we'll look at animated GIFs of this eventually. But if one is like twice the other, then they're going to be close together again and again and again at the same location in the orbit. And what it's going to do is to modify the orbit a little bit, increase the eccentricity of the orbit, because the pull, is actually coming always at the same location. And of course, once you increase the eccentricity of one of these orbits of the ring particle, it becomes highly likely to crash into a neighboring ring particle. And so by this mechanism, you clear out rings. So that's maybe a little bit obscure mechanism, but it's probably, well, it's a very important mechanism. Another important mechanism was discovered only when we got up close to these rings. And then we could see that often in these gaps, there were what are called shepherding satellites that are clearing out a ring of material, you know, essentially by colliding with it and getting rid of it. And if we look at the rings of Saturn, there are literally millions of little ringlets that make up what looks like a solid ring from Earth. And certainly not in all cases can we see a shepherding satellite that's in those little ring gaps. Okay, so zillions of orbiting ice particles, not uniformly sculpted by resonance and by shepherding satellites. Darker material, also in orbit. All of these things are probably in some sense temporary. That is to say, over time, these small particles will re-enter the atmosphere of the planets. But if you have enough icebergs floating around, as in the case of Saturn, they're probably going to different individual icebergs, but over time, the rings probably of Saturn are going to be around for a long time. It has zillions of these little moons that could contribute to ice in the future. Questions about rings? So the one moon we talked about last time is Titan, and to some approximation, it's the most interesting of them. Yeah, I think I believe that. So it's got a tremendous atmosphere. Some of the other moons have small change atmospheres, but this one has a huge atmosphere. with an atmospheric pressure that's like 1.5 times the Earth's atmospheric pressure, and an atmosphere that is mostly nitrogen, just as the Earth's atmosphere is mostly nitrogen. And we're going to have clouds and rains and lakes. We have a repetition of all these things we have on Earth, but with a little twist. We're at much colder temperatures. So water is rock at these temperatures. What can be lakes and clouds and rain is hydrocarbons, things like gasoline. So we're thinking about ethane and methane, clouds and lakes that are going to dot the surface. And we see flow features, and we see things that are certainly lakes on the surface of this moon. Generally speaking, this moon is cloud covered so that we can't see with visible light these features. So we see pictures like this in infrared and radar pictures of from the Cassini orbiter and lander that have been around, continue to be around Saturn. So all of these moons that we're going to talk about are tidally locked. So their rotation period is the same as their orbital period. So generally speaking, they're slow spinning planets. So this is another planet that lacks the Coriolis force, essentially. And it has pretty long lasting and large seasons. Currently, we think we're seeing a Hadley cell, but a Hadley cell like Mars's at summer, that goes actually connects pole to pole, as it were, as opposed to being a Hadley cell that spans the that starts and stops at the equator. Questions on those guys? So here's kind of the lineup of moons that I care about. And we talked a little bit about Triton last time. It's the moon of Neptune, and it has a small change atmosphere. Mostly what we're going to be thinking about today, though, are the moons of Jupiter. So the closest in moon is Io, then Europa, then Ganymede, and then Callisto. And they're all pretty comparable in size to the Earth's moon. If we look in terms of density, which gives us some clue as to what's what, let me move it off screen. If we think about the solar system writ large, generally speaking, close to the sun, we've got the rocky planets, and further out, we've got the gaseous planets. So if we're going to make a guess as to how that works with Jupiter, if this is kind of a junior solar system, we would guess that the rockier moons are going to be the ones that are closest to Jupiter. And as we move out, we're going to get to more icy moons. So we're expecting then that the closest moon, Io, is going to have a density, equivalent to rock, something like the moon, maybe 3.5. And as we move out, we're going to get things that are closer to 2. And you can see that things pretty much bear this out. So here's Io with a density of 3.5, pretty much, in fact, even more dense than the moon, I guess. And as we move out to Europa, 3, then Ganymede, and now we're into this range that is basically a 50-50 mix of rock and ice. So the densities make some sort of sense in thinking about Jupiter as being a junior version of the solar system. And I think the best way to appreciate these moons is to look at pictures. Okay, so where do I want to start? I don't want to start with the video. Hmm. So this is a, well, maybe I will start with a video. I don't see the picture that I like the best of Io. Guess I won't start with that one. So this is Io. It looks kind of like a pizza. And the things that you might think are impact craters, those little black dots, they're not impact craters. They're basically no impact craters on Io. So the lack of impact craters says there has to be some sort of geological activity that is going on, right? Generally speaking, we think that small planets are going to have already cooled off, and so they should be geologically dead. But here we have something that is comparable to our moon in size, but has tremendous activity. And the nature of that activity, I'm going to want to show that video. Okay. So when spacecraft went by, they saw this, and then it became perfectly clear that there are always active volcanoes on Io, multiple of them, and they are spewing out material over a huge range of space that is constantly resurfacing the moon. So why? Why is this small ember, in fact, so geologically active? So where is that? So what we've got with the Galilean moons is another example of resonance. So in the time it takes Ganymede to go around once, if you count, you'll see that Io goes around 4 times and that Europa goes around 2 times. So for example, every time that Europa is there at the top of the screen, notice that Io is also there at the top of the screen. So every time they're close together, the pull is happening at the exact same location. And the same thing is true of Ganymede, except Europa is going around multiple times. It's always going to be close to Ganymede 3 times. Once there, there's the other one, there's the other one. So the perturbations from these moons always occur at the same spots in the orbit. And what this is going to do is it's going to perturb the orbit. So the orbit is going to be a little bit eccentric. Not much. Not nearly as eccentric as, say, the Earth's orbit is, but we're close to this big object, Jupiter. So this means that sometimes the planet is, several thousand miles closer to Jupiter, and sometimes it's further away. When it's closer to Jupiter, there'll be a stronger tidal force. So what's happening is we have a big tidal force that's going to elongate the moon, and then the moon moves away and the tidal force is reduced. Then it comes into Jupiter and it's elongated, and then it's pushed away from Jupiter and it's spherical. So it's like this moon is constantly being kneaded the way dough would be kneaded by Jupiter. And this constant massage is, we think, what is heating up the interior of these planets, making them be as geologically active as they seem to be. So this is a little bit different/the same as the ring situation. So these resonances are causing changes in eccentricity, but in this case there isn't something to run into. So that eccentricity is just constantly present, and it's leading to this kneading phenomena that is heating up these three moons with profound effects according to the surfaces of these moons. So if we looked at Io, so next out is going to be Europa. So Europa obviously has craters, but not nearly as much cratering as, say, the moon has. So we've got a youngish surface, but as I say, considerably older than, or not nearly as old as the moon is. But you can see here, for example, way fewer craters. And the kind of striking feature of Europa is that it's surprisingly smooth. There's nothing kind of like highlands and lowlands. And if we take spectra of the surface of Europa, it reads as ice. So we've got a very icy surface, which is presumably occasionally heated up, and we get cracking on the surface, and new ice wells up from below. So our best guess is that there's actually, if we go below the ice, there's actually an ocean of water underneath Europa. And it's one of the spots that people think is a candidate place to look for for life in this ocean that presumably underlies the ice for Europa. Yeah, okay. I was wondering what that one was. So here's kind of a close-up picture of the cracking on Europa. And regions like this, which is called the chaos terrain, the kind of the best guess is that there's a layer in the ice that consists of liquid water. So this is a lake in the solid ice crust. If we go down 100 kilometers, that's where we get kind of this full ocean. But right here, there's probably 20 kilometers down, a diaper, as it were, of salty water. So not pure water, but water that has mixed in with a lot of the ice. So very, very smooth terrain, very few craters. You can see there are some, you can see that there are some craters. Those craters are pretty clearly washed out by some sort of process. So a young surface made out of ice, and presumably kept refreshing itself because of this heating that comes about because of the resonance. So as we go further out, we're going to hit Ganymede. And Ganymede has craters. We'll see in a minute a bigger picture. It has lots of craters, but it also has the same relatively crater-free area. Let's see what else we got. So here's kind of a large-scale picture of Ganymede. This darker terrain is kind of like the highlands. It has substantially more craters than we have in the lighter regions. And again, we're going to distinguish this based on kind of old ice and new ice. But you can see there are lots more craters here than there were on Europa. So older surface, but still probably not as old as the moon. Even though it's comparable in size of the moon, and a priori you would think it would have cooled off. Okay, so we have those three that are involved in this this resonance system. The last guy out is Callisto, and you know, there it is, right? So striking difference between the guy that's out of resonance and the guy that's in resonance. So here we have basically 100% crater coverage, and presumably a very old surface. Our best guess is that Callisto is a relatively undifferentiated object. So you remember, differentiation has to do with the heavy stuff sinking and the lighter stuff coming to the surface. The moment of inertia of Callisto kind of indicates that it's, if it has an iron core, it's a very small sort of iron core. So it's simply a very old, cold object. Kind of in contrast to Ganymede. So of these three guys, one of the ways we have of measuring internal geological activity has to do with the presence of a magnetic field. So all these guys are slow rotators because they're in synchronous orbit. So we think that spin is also required for a magnetic field. But Ganymede actually has its own magnetic field. So that's clear evidence of a conducting, convecting fluid for Ganymede. It tures out that Io and Europa respond to the magnetic field of Jupiter in a way that suggests that they have a fairly conducting fluid on their inside, but they don't actually produce their own magnetic field the way Ganymede does. I don't know, so here's again, look at these volcanoes. What's coming out of these volcanoes in Io, you can see thrown to great heights, is probably not mostly rock, but probably things like sulfur compounds, sulfur oxides, water, icy sort of stuff coming from all of these mostly icy planets. So here's again, heavily cratered Callisto. This is presumably one very big crater that kind of caused these ripples throughout the planet, throughout the moon. I think we looked at that one, didn't we? We looked at that one. So this is really kind of jumping ahead a little bit, but we're here, and it's probably as good a time as any to think about it. So you know that the asteroid belt lies between Mars and Jupiter. So you might think about it as kind of being like a ring around the sun. And you know that moons of Saturn affect the concentration of ring particles through this resonant process. So maybe something similar will happen to the asteroid belt. Maybe there will be absences of asteroids at places that are in resonance with Jupiter. And those are called the Kirkwood gaps, and you can see that they certainly exist. We have kind of holes in the distribution of asteroids at places where we have kind of nice integer ratios of the orbit period with the orbit period of Jupiter. Jupiter being by far the biggest perturber in the solar system. Okay, so we looked at these pictures of Titan last time. I don't see any reason to look at them again, but there's kind of the most recent version of it. This is false color. They really don't have these sorts of colors, but we really do think that these things are lakes. We see them expand under the influence of what sure look like rain clouds, and we think we see nice flow features, but all that's hydrocarbon that's doing the flowing. And we looked a little bit at Neptune's moon, Triton. Kind of looks like a cantaloupe. Again, absence of craters indicates that that some geological process is heating this moon up. In this particular case, there doesn't seem to be a resonance involved. So it's a little bit more of a mystery. And the mystery deepens because out of all of the moons we've been talking about, Triton goes around the wrong way. That is to say, all of these moons have been rotating around the planet, orbiting the planet in the same direction that the planet spins. This is the exception. And the best guess is that this is a captured object, probably very similar to Pluto, and it was captured in an orbit that happened to be not consistent with the direction that the planet was rotating, a retrograde orbit. And as a result, the future is pretty clear. Because the moon is slowly moving out from the Earth because it's orbiting in the same direction as the Earth is going. It turns out that retrograde objects, if they're close enough in, their future is to crash into the planet. So Titan, unless it is again disrupted by some process, Triton should crash into Neptune at some point in the very distant future. So what's resurfacing Triton? Well, we saw things like, we saw those huge umbrella things of Io, and we see very similar features for Triton. So it's not crater free. You can see that crater there, but it certainly a very old surface. Same thing in black and white, the sort of mottled surface. So we see geysers that are geysing out of the... So here's the very thin cloud layer we can see on Triton. And these are these streaks. Okay. So let's say kind of it all again with the lights on. So what we've got with the moons of Jupiter is kind of a junior version of the solar system. The moons that are close to Jupiter are the ones that have the highest density. So Io has a density that's more than the density of moon, comparable to the density of the moon. As we work our way out to Callisto, we get these densities that are basically close to two, a 50-50 mix of rock and ice. For these three guys, they're in this resonance. In every orbit of Ganymede, Europa orbits twice and Io orbits four times, and that leads to small eccentricities in the orbit. So these planets are moving in and out in Jupiter's gravitational field, so the tidal force on them, the force that's trying to elongate the planet, is coming and going, and it's kind of kneading the planet, which is heating them up. So all of these things show signs of relatively recent geological activity in contrast to Callisto. The closer we are to Jupiter, the more intense the geological activity is. So here we always see, every time we go, a spacecraft goes by Io, there are half a dozen active volcanoes erupting on the surface. And I think zero impact craters have been discovered on Io. It's probably resurfaced in a very short time scale. So oddly enough, the most geologically active object in the solar system is not a particularly big object. It's one of the smallish sorts of things. You can see smaller than our moon. Europa kind of one step out. We don't see active volcanoes here, but we see a very flat, icy surface with very few impact craters. Looks like there's a liquid water, saltwater ocean that's maybe 100 kilometers down. And it's a possible site for people to look for life. We have systems of living things on Earth that are totally disconnected from the sun. They just survive on geological vents that are deep under the ocean. And something like that seems like a possibility for Europa, that in the 100% darkness, 100 kilometers down under all of this ice, there possibly could be something similar going on. But frankly, it's real difficult to see how we would ever detect it. We can't go down, I think, more than about 10 kilometers in the Earth's surface where we have, you know, 100% support, let alone going down 100 kilometers on this isolated moon. People have some hope that maybe what would happen in some of these relatively fresh cracks, we would have some water that was relatively recently, you know, a million years ago, part of this ocean, and maybe it would show fossils of these proposed microscopic creatures. It wouldn't be my first place to look for life, but it's on the list of candidate places. Ganymede, again, there's pretty much a gradient in how many craters we have on the surface, which indicates how old the surface is. So Ganymede seems to have some sort of geological activity, but not nearly as much as the others. Also believed to have this kind of ocean underneath it, and it's got its own magnetic field, and it seems to be the most differentiated of the moons of Jupiter. And then Triton, which is kind of interesting because it's retrograde, indicating that it's captured. Geologically active, relatively few craters. We've imaged geysers on the surface of Triton. Something that some people call an atmosphere, but not me. Very, very rarefied gas. And we think it's probably a stand-in for Pluto. We've got a spacecraft that's on its way to Pluto, so, I don't know, 5 years, something like that. We should have pictures of the surface of Pluto. But for the time being, we think that Triton is probably a pretty good rendition of what Pluto will look like. an X planet of density of about 2 that's probably a mixture of ice and rock, but probably lacks the active geological features that Triton has. And Triton is doomed to crash into Neptune at some point. There's another sign that something disruptive happened to the moon system around Neptune, and that is, generally speaking, all of these moons have very small eccentricities. So we talked about the resonance driving an eccentricity of these moons, but the eccentricity is actually only about 1/1000th in contrast to the few percent eccentricity of the Earth. So the one moon that is highly eccentric, that if you were to look at it, you would see, that's an ellipse, turns out to be a smallish moon of Neptune. So kind of the idea is that the same time Triton was captured, it disrupted that moon and put it in a highly eccentric orbit. Questions on any of that? Okay, so you can kind of draw a line in your notes to indicate that's kind of the end of what'll be on the exam. So I want to go on and talk about the other sorts of objects that are present in the solar system, and probably the next most prominent one are comets. So comets are things that are on highly elliptical orbits. So so this might be the orbit of Jupiter, for example. They generally spend their lifetime in the very distant cold regions of the solar system. But every time they approach the sun, they get hot, and they're probably made mostly of ice. A lot of that ice starts to evaporate, and so we produce all of this material that is being beaten out of the comet as it approaches the sun. So the tail of the comet, all of that stuff is material that's been eliminated from the actual cometary core. So that means these things aren't that big to begin with. The nucleus may be 1 or 10 kilometers. We have pictures from a few nuclei. We've sent several spacecraft at this point in flybys of comets. And typically, we can calculate that these things lose on the order of a meter or 10 meters of their surface material every time they approach the sun. So I can do the math. They probably only survive on the order of 1,000 close approaches to the sun. So something like Halley's Comet, which has a period of about 75 years, in geologically very short time, it's going to be gone. So why is it that we still have comets around? Right? If they can only last a few million years, and we think that the solar system is 4.5 billion years old, they clearly haven't been doing the same thing for the last 4.5 billion years. So we think that most of the comets aren't on orbits like that. They're on orbits that are very distant from the sun, in constant cold. So they're being kept in cold storage. And there are kind of two regions that we think that cometary storage occurs. There's the Kuiper Belt. Kuiper is a person. And there's the Oort cloud, which is even further out. So the Oort cloud would extend to maybe 10% of the distance to the nearest star. It's the very distant stuff that was left over from the early formation of the solar system. And then we have this stuff that's kind of just outside the orbit of Neptune. So these days, Pluto is considered a Kuiper Belt object as opposed to a planet on its own right. So these things are sitting out there in cold storage. They have gravitational interactions, near collisions with each other, and that puts them onto these orbits that start to go close to the sun. And after 1,000 orbits around the sun, they've disappeared, they've evaporated, and we have to wait for another comet to be perturbed into an orbit that we can actually see. So we think that there are billions of these cometary nuclei that are in cold storage, so we're not in any danger of depleting them. leftover icebergs from the early formation of the solar system. So in terms of the structure, if you look at a comet through a telescope, which is in some sense not the right thing to do because they're pretty large and dim objects if they're nice to look at, typically what you're seeing is a fuzzy ball that is the coma. The actual little dot that is the nucleus, it's only a few kilometers in size, you're not going to see that with a telescope. So kind of ignore that feature. So we've got a fuzzy cloud, and then we have stuff that's being blown off of that cloud. And I guess this is another, so if the comet is going this way, the tail, so the comet is going this way at this point, the tail is always, of course, going to be pointed away from the sun. So the tail isn't something that is trailing behind the nucleus the way a flag trails behind the car if you're going at high speed. It's always pointing in the opposite direction from the sun, which is the thing that's causing the tail to exist. The tail typically comes in a couple of types, and sometimes we see double tails like this. So if the material gets ionized by the UV radiation from the sun, then it turns out it's going to join the solar wind, the general stream of material that's moving directly away from the sun. If it remains unionized, then it follows the comet's orbit, and so it's going to trail behind the comet in typically a different direction. So different material following different paths, the ion material being caught up with the ionized material that's leaving the sun, the solar wind, and the dust trail following the trail of the orbit of rocks that are orbiting the sun. Okay? And this whole process, of course, you know, is going to take 75 years or so in the case of Halley's Comet. Even the period that is close to the sun is going to take many, many days or months. So sometimes people have the impression that a comet is going to go whishing across the sky the way an airplane wishes across the sky. And that's not the case. The comet is going to be like a planet. It's going to rise in the east and set in the west and be pretty much in the same constellation day after day after day, and only gradually move from constellation to constellation. Okay, so we've got these icebergs that are out beyond the orbit of Neptune, some of which are swishing through the inner solar system in order to form these comets. So the other thing we've got is the asteroid belt. So asteroids are relatively big rocks. They're not just in the asteroid belt between Mars and Jupiter. They're spread around the entire solar system. And in fact, there's a big group of them that are co-orbiting with Jupiter. So it turns out that for any any case where you have two objects that are orbiting around around each other, and I'll start with the Earth and the Moon. So here's the orbit of the Moon around the Earth. It turns out that at a spot that is on the Moon's orbit but 60 degrees in front of the Moon, and a spot on the Moon's orbit that is 60 degrees behind the Moon, those are what are called Lagrange points, and they're stable equilibria. That is to say, if you put a rock here, it'll stay there. It won't get pushed around to a different location. And only recently have we found objects that are orbiting in the Moon's path at these Lagrange points. Occasionally people talk about putting spacecraft there so that they wouldn't have to be constantly pumped up to higher orbits the way the space station does. But for a long time we've known about objects that are in Jupiter's orbit. So if this is Jupiter, we see objects that are 60 degrees ahead and 60 degrees behind Jupiter that are conglomerations of dozens of asteroids that are co-orbiting with Jupiter at about five times the distance that the Earth is orbiting from Jupiter. And similarly, there are asteroids that are going to intersect the Earth's orbit, and presumably it's big rocks like that occasionally intersect with the Earth's atmosphere and make meteors. So meteors are the flash of light in the sky. And of course, if those meteors hit the Earth, then we've got meteorites. Before they hit the Earth, they're called meteoroids. None of these distinctions do I much care about, but you'll see them occasionally. So NASA has a project now to look at some of these asteroids, and we started with the small ones. So we have pictures of now maybe half a dozen asteroids. And currently, NASA has a spacecraft orbiting around the second biggest asteroid, Vesta. And after it spends, a year at Vesta, the plan is to move it on to the biggest asteroid, Ceres. So let's take a look at some of these asteroid pictures. So these are some of the early ones that were imaged with relatively small asteroids on the order of 100 miles in size. So you can see they just look like irregular rocks. They've been beaten up. They've got impact craters. There's no reason for them to be spherical because their gravitational pull isn't strong enough to pull them together given their relatively modest size. So one of the nice things about this asteroid is that it had an orbiting body. And remember, if we have an orbiting body, we can calculate the mass of the central body. So we can get an idea of the density of this object and exactly what it's made out of. So again, irregular. Another irregular asteroid, heavily cratered. So this is a somewhat false colored image. The color has been exaggerated. It would still look kind of like a dull gray. So here's a picture of these asteroids. So I was mentioning the Trojans that are 60 degrees ahead of Jupiter and 60 degrees behind Jupiter. And here we have this big asteroid belt, but it's not only confined to the asteroid belt. We've also got asteroids that are occasionally intersecting the orbit of Earth. Another rocky clump. So these things are way outside of the Roche limit of the sun, and so they can have accumulated small rocks. If you drop a rock on this guy, it's going to stay with that guy as opposed to in the ring objects. Okay, so recently we've got pictures from Vesta. So this is the best we could do with Vesta from the Hubble Space Telescope. You can't tell much from that. So this is a close-up. You can see the scale marker. So heavily cratered surface. If you look in detail at the shape of these craters, they differ from the craters in the moon, which typically have flatter bottoms. And presumably that's because a lot of the debris falls back on Mars. These things are small enough that a lot of the debris here is going to escape from the surface of the asteroid. So here's a full 360-degree view of this thing. So you can see it's not exactly spherical. It's got a kind of potato-ish shape. And it's got these equatorial grooves that you can see that are usually attributed to a huge impact in the southern hemisphere. So I don't know if this is going to convince you that it's an impact crater, but that's what's on the bottom. And the best guess is this was an impact with something that had a size almost comparable to Vesta itself. It turns out that we think we have pieces of Vesta. So Vesta has a pretty unusual spectra. So remember that we can figure out the composition of gases by the line absorptions. But for solids, it's a lot trickier because they don't have really strongly distinguishing characteristics. So in terms of rocks that we hold on to, carbonaceous rocks are ones that you can see are very dark, not particularly reflective, basically black, but there isn't anything that's astounding that makes that singles that out from a lot of other things. But Vesta has a pretty unusual spectra, and we find meteorites that we can hold in our hands that match the spectra of Vesta. So we're pretty sure that these meteorites are from Vesta, and they're probably related to this big impact, which happened long ago, but not super long ago. You can notice that there, this region of this huge crater, there are not a whole lot of recent craters. So this is a somewhat fresh impact that presumably blasted a lot of Vesta apart into small bits, many of which have since intersected the Earth's orbit. So here's something, a piece of Vesta that has not recently blasted away. So it's got basically cheek to jowl craters, kind of the way the old surfaces of the moon have. And you can kind of see this is a high scale image. I think about 100 meters is the smallest thing that you can see in this picture. These are the remnants of the grooves that we saw around the equator in the rotating image. Here's just another image of these two craters are called the snowmen, kind of for obvious reasons. Another kind of random piece of the of Vesta's surface. So currently, spacecraft is in orbit around Vesta. It doesn't have that big of a gravitational pull, so it won't be that hard to leave Vesta and go on to another asteroid. Typically, we don't do that with other planets, right? If we have a probe on Saturn like Cassini, it's going to stay at Saturn. It actually flew by Jupiter on its way to Saturn. But once you've slowed down enough to be captured as a moon into a planet, it's not worth the rocket fuel to break out of that orbit and go to another planet. But it's no big deal to go from one asteroid to another in the asteroid belt. So I think in about a year's time, the plan is to move the spacecraft to Ceres. So that's what we know about Ceres now. Right? That's the Hubble Space Telescope of Ceres. And you know, it's hard to say much. It's spherical. It's a big enough moon. So it turns out that this asteroid has more mass than all the rest of the asteroids combined. So sometimes you hear the story that the asteroid belt is a destroyed planet. Well, there aren't enough asteroids to make a reasonable size planet, right? So if you brought them all together, it'd just be a little bit bigger than this guy by itself. And this guy by itself, you know, is pretty small change. So this comparison, not a real shot, of course, comparison shot between Earth, Moon, and Ceres. So there isn't a lot of stuff in the asteroid belt in total. So we should have, relatively soon, much better pictures than what we've currently got of Ceres. Okay, questions? Well, I think rather than go on to a new topic, it's probably smart to leave the rocky things of the solar system before we go on to talk about the sun, which is kind of the next one up. So I'm going to call it quits. Any questions on anything? Hope I see lots of you at the help session or at my office.